Hi, and welcome to Understory, WA's only environmental radio show. I'm your host, Tom Wilson. Today, Row 8, Climate Skepticism and a Historical View of What Caused the Deaths of the Dolphins in the Swan River. But first to the highway, known as Row 8. On November 4th last year, I put to air a little bit of audio from a rally to save Northlake from a big fat road going straight through it. It was a stirring day with plenty of protesters on the ground under some beautiful early summer sunshine. Since that time on November 4th of last year, the federal government has given the green light to plenty of destruction of the bush just around the corner from there at Jandakot Airport. Over at Jandakot, 167 hectares has been given the green light for destruction with the rubber stamp of approval coming from the federal Labor Party. Now, 2010, the Liberal state government continues to push ahead with more destruction of bush in this area south of the Swan River. So what's happened since Understory reported the issue last year? I visited Lynn McLaren, MLC representing the South Metro area for the Greens, at her office in Fremantle. Lynn gave me an update on the Row 8 highway extension controversy. What exactly is Row 8?
So, well, what they're trying to do now is extend the Row Highway. Right now, the Row Highway ends at the Kwinana Freeway, and they're wanting to link it up to ports. That's what they say. That's why they think it's necessary. So Row Highway Stage 8 is the next little piece of that highway. Now, at the moment, they're not even proposing to build Stage 8, which would have connected the Kwinana Freeway to what has been deleted as the Eastern Bypass, the Fremantle Eastern Bypass. So that big stretch of road in between Jandakot and Fremantle, really, cutting through a huge area of suburbs and this beautiful lakes area, would be called Row 8. All that the government is proposing now is this tiny little piece, which is a couple of kilometers long, through the wetlands, and they're calling it Row 8 Extension. And they're spending a fortune to try to, first of all, convince the public that they need it, and secondly, build this road, which they know should not be impacting negatively on the environment.
So you don't think there's a case for our needing this extension?
Absolutely not. This is a road which was planned way back in the 50s. It is no longer necessary. We've deleted the Fremantle Eastern Bypass on the western side, and basically the east-west traffic is going to go far further south to get to the ports in the south, which now we know that Fremantle Port is going to be partially, if moving to the south to Coburn Sound. So this traffic, which this was prepared, this road was planned for, is not going to be coming through this area. Traffic that's going from Kewdale and areas to the east to the Fremantle Port clearly goes down Leach Highway. They are not going to come further south to get onto this little bypass and then cut up north to get to the Fremantle Port. So the road itself is unnecessary. And unfortunately, because this government doesn't have an updated transport plan, they're just going back to this old plan from the 50s, and they're trying to piece it together. At a post time when we managed to delete the Fremantle Eastern Bypass for precisely the reason that it was an unnecessary road, they're not updating the rest of the road network that led into it. So, it's unnecessary. And coupled with what we now know about the carbon world and how carbon is, well, nobody wants to use as much fuel as we've been using before on transport. So other options of transport, like rail, are much more and going to be much more lucrative and more efficient as are in a carbon-constrained world. So to look towards the future instead of the past, the government has to move freight on rail, and they need to look at other options for moving people around as well, and that will reduce the need for roads to have light rail systems and more heavy rail systems for passengers in the metropolitan area. That is the way forward. That's where they should be spending the money.
Okay, and so if this does happen, what are the ecological impacts going to be on North and Bibra Lakes, on the bushland, on the animals?
It's going to be devastating, Tom, and that's the real key to this issue. You cannot bisect a wetland and anticipate that it's going to survive. For some reason, these engineers are trying to figure out a way to innovatively build this road to dissect these two lakes, which we know from now with modern science of hydrology about how important it is that the underground hydrology is not bisected. So what happens when you cut across it is you're basically cutting off its lungs. This is one of the last places left. If you look on the Metropolitan Region map, look in your UBD, and you will see that most of our wetlands have been crisscrossed by roads and suburbs. And right now, our groundwater is a critical threat from this kind of urban development. And we need to have these lungs to keep our groundwater freshened and to make sure that our ecosystems are sustained so that we can live here in Perth. And that's,
so you're saying it's actually important for humans as well as animals.
Exactly. I'm starting from that position. But the fact is that habitat has gradually been lost over, the last, say, 50 years. If you look at even since when the car became more prevalent and the use of the car became more prevalent and the growth of the population in Perth, I tell the story about how when I was here in 1979 and I got a magical trip on a plane from Jandakot Airport, and a friend of mine said, you know, this pilot had to keep up his hour, so let's drive down to Jandakot and we'll show you the city at sunset. And getting from South Perth to Jandakot was mostly bushland. There was, apart from right around the city, right around the river, there was quite a lot of bushland, and now you know that it's wall-to-wall suburb. It's wall-to-wall rooftops. At that time, when you got up into the air and you looked down at the city, you could see lots of lakes, lots of wetlands, and beautiful green carpet. And that's part of what attracted me to living here, is this sense of living in harmony with the environment. And now when you do that, anybody that gets up there will tell you the glare from all the rooftops is, you know, enough to make you look away and probably keep your eyes on the horizon. So the Perth metropolitan region has been allowed to sprawl out and basically pave over all the habitat for the animals that live here. So again, this is one of the few places left in the South metropolitan region that is not developed as an urban jungle. And we have a chance to save it. We have a chance to provide habitat for Carnaby's cockatoos that we know live there. It's habitat for frogs. It's habitat for several skinks and different reptiles. And it's not only got that richness of flora and fauna that are endemic to this region, which is a biodiversity hotspot after all. You know, this Perth metropolitan region is a biodiversity hotspot, and here's a place that we've got left, and we should save it as a contiguous area. But it's not just for the plants and animals that live there. This is a place of rich Aboriginal heritage, and we know that Aboriginal groups use this area. It's got tremendous cultural significance. And that alone is reason to keep it, keep from cutting a path through it. Together, it is part of a mythological site, and I think that if our planning authorities could value that, that would be enough to stop this road.
Okay, and so what is the timeline for if this does happen? When will it happen?
Looks like the South Metro Connect will be making their report over the next couple of months. That'll go to the EPA for assessment, and that should actually come out to the public. So we should have a chance to comment on that, and people are encouraged to do that. And it'll probably be, like most controversial projects, over the Christmas-January period.
So people should watch their papers early next year to comment and possibly protest this project going ahead.
Yeah, and if you want to keep in touch with that, there's several groups that are working on this campaign. One of the main websites is SaveBelierWetlands.com. That's SaveBelierWetlands.com. They also have a Facebook page if you wanted to jump onto that. And that is, I think it's Save Biliar Wetlands and Stop Row 8 Highway. So if you jumped onto those pages, they will give you not only the up-to-date information about when the EPA is asking for you to comment, but they may give you some suggestions about what you can include in your submission. So,
And I mean, this is pretty important, isn't it? I mean, this is, if you do care about the natural world and you live in Perth, this would have to be possibly the biggest issue right now in terms of the destruction of what bush we have left in Perth.
Absolutely. This is a very serious incursion into our native environment. It's an unnecessary road. There's an argument against it. It's a very expensive road. Economically, it doesn't make sense. And the cost to our native environment is too dear. So I encourage everybody to get active on this campaign. This is a watershed campaign for the environment in this area. But if you never visited Bibber Lake or North Lake, come on down. This Saturday is a great time to do that. There's a Festival of the Lakes, and there'll be lots of activities down there. There's going to be...
So that's this Saturday, the 9th of October.
That's right, yeah, the 9th of October. Come down the 9th of October from 6 a.m. to 4 p.m. to the Bibber Lake and Biliar Wetlands, and there's going to be music, there's going to be a train going around the lake. There's going to be gift stalls, there's local arts and crafts, and some of the history of the area will be on display, including photography. And if you can check out the Wetlands Center. A lot of kids who've gone to school in this area have gone to the Wetlands Center for science projects. It's a really good resource, and they'll probably know where it is. It's off Hope Road, but you can come down to Progress Drive and Hope Road, and there's so many activities. This Saturday is a good time to come down and show that you care about the lakes and just enjoy them while they're there. Part of saving these lakes is just encouraging people to enjoy them.
Okay, well, thank you very much. That was Lynn McLaren representing the Greens in the Upper House of the State Parliament. Now we hear from Stephen Lewandowski from the School of Psychology at UWA. Steve brings us one of his regular segments on climate skepticism.
Suppose a bloke drifts up to you and says, "Apples don't exist." While your eyebrows are still rising, he adds, "But they grow naturally on trees." What? Apples don't exist, but they grow naturally on trees? Surely you wouldn't trust that bloke with the lives of your children if their future depended on logical coherence. Now suppose you walk down the street and some other guy sidles up and says, "The price of sheep is unknown, but I'd buy some now because they're cheap." Excuse me? The price of sheep is unknown, but they're cheap? No point trusting that bloke with your kids' lives either. Now here's a surprising thing to think about. Your kids' future and the future of their kids very much depends on logical coherence. Very much hinges on protecting them and their future from the incoherent claims of so-called climate skeptics. One of the reliable insights of philosophy of science has been that scientific knowledge is virtually never incoherent. In science, the hallmark criterion of whether you can possibly be right is whether or not you are coherent. If you're coherent, you might be right. If you're incoherent, or contradict yourself, then you are most likely wrong. The beauty of this is that you don't even need data or peer-reviewed science to be sure. If an argument is incoherent or mutually contradictory, then you can be fairly confident that it is wrong or stated for entertainment purposes only. What does this have to do with so-called climate skeptics? Everything. Because the sum total of so-called skeptic arguments is an incoherent muddle of contradictions. On a Monday morning, your resident skeptic might tell you that global warming doesn't exist. On the Monday afternoon, she may tell you that the warming is all natural, just the same way that non-existent apples grow on trees. Nothing this incoherent can be right. And on Tuesday, a so-called skeptic may drift into town and make claims about the temperature record not being accurate. He might also assure you that there's nothing to worry about because it hasn't been warming in the last 23 days anyhow. So, the sheep are cheap, but no one knows their price. Nothing this incoherent can be right. By Wednesday morning, your excited skeptic, so-called, may have invented the possibility that the sun is causing global warming, and by afternoon tea time it might be cosmic rays, El Nino, or Inspector Clouseau, or whatever. Now, you may find it hard to believe that anyone could be so muddled, but in fact, it takes little effort to go to a skeptic, so-called, website, and dig out dozens, if not hundreds, such contradictions. Hundreds of instances in which apples were said not to exist, but then happily grow on trees. Hundreds of clear indications that this so-called skepticism amounts to little more than muddled mutterings. There is, of course, a coherent alternative. It is the coherent and overwhelmingly supported scientific fact that the Earth's climate is warming and that humans are largely responsible for that. That is coherent, backed by peer-reviewed science, and endorsed by all major scientific organizations in the world. For more details about the importance of coherence in science, and to comment on this piece, visit www.skepticalscience.com, which informs about climate change by relying entirely on the peer-reviewed literature.
That was Stephen Lewandowski from the School of Psychology at the University of Western Australia. Finally today, we hear from historian Sue Graham-Taylor about the recent deaths of dolphins in the Swan River. Has the recent investigation into these deaths given us the full picture of the problems of the swan? According to Sue, history has been unfairly left out of the whole discussion.
Last year, there were six dolphin deaths, six Swan River dolphin deaths, and there were also some dolphin deaths around Bunbury. And the six deaths in the Swan River represented a marked increase in mortalities, and it occurred in two lots, three in June and three in September-October last year. They completed post-mortem examinations of four of the dolphins.
So what do you think the community was upset by this? Were you reading the papers at the time?
I think there was a wide level of community interest in the results of the post-mortems, and there was quite concern for the fate of the Swan River dolphins because they are quite iconic to people, you know, who enjoy seeing them going up and down the river. And it wasn't until the report of Murdoch University's vet school that indicated that there were several factors that combined on the deaths of at least four of them. And that was the fact that two of them had skin lesions caused by a pox virus, and that's the first time that's been confirmed in Western Australia. But the more worrying thing was that all had suppressed immune systems, all had high levels of dieldrin in their tissue, also high levels of PCVs and DET. And dolphins, as you know, are the top of the food chain and a real indication of the health of the river. And I think the six deaths have highlighted to us just the problems we face with the Swan and Canning rivers.
Yeah, I mean, I've gone over the Stirling Bridge and Canning Bridges plenty of times and seen dolphins in the river around UWA in the river and thought, what a great thing to see big wild animals in the centre of our urban metropolis. Really refreshing sight. And then to see some of the photos that the Murdoch Vet School took when they were doing the autopsies on the dolphins of horrible skin lesions and fishing wire knotted in the fins of the animals. It was pretty disturbing to see that. Looking as you can historically at the Swan River, how does this fit into the grand scheme of the river's highs and lows, ups and downs over the years?
But I think it's interesting because the chief scientist was asked to to provide advice and recommendations on the fish deaths and handed this report to the minister in April this year.
Yep.
And this highlights, you know, that the rivers have changed and that the possibility is that the dolphins were exposed to contaminants and stress induced by human activities. But the report is worrying to me in that it has so little information about dolphins. You know, in 2001 to 3, there was a bit of research done, which hasn't been analysed. And more recently, the Swan River Trust has set up a dolphin watch program, which is very successful to get people to report, you know, what they see and which dolphins they see and where. But, you know, I really feel that the whole role of history has been ignored, because you can actually get quite a good idea of what we've done to the river and how it impacted on dolphins by looking at history. Well, of course, you know, we've really impacted on the river in terms of shaping it and straightening it and reclaiming it. I think a lot of our legacies remain, particularly in the area of pollution. You know, around the banks of the river, there are about 22 tip sites. You know, in those days, we felt that we had to reclaim the river. We had to fill it in because the mosquitoes were making us sick, because the smells of the river were making us sick. But we filled it in with our rubbish, which became increasingly toxic. And, you know, I think those rubbish tips and other industrial facilities around the river are still having an impact on the river today. We have a lot of knowledge now on the nutrients going into the river, but we don't actually have a lot of knowledge on the contaminants going in from all the drains, from the old industrial sites and from the tip sites. And I think this report highlights that we do really need to increase that knowledge. You know, I think...
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty scary to hear that there was DDT in the bodies of these dolphins.
Yep, and there, you know, I really think we need to do, or spend a lot more money for a start on the river, because we need to do a lot more monitoring as to the sources of these contaminants, and also, you know, maybe some intervention measures will be needed to try to look at the hot spots of contamination, you know, the heavy metals, the dieldrin, the DDTs, the PCBs. We need to look at where those hotspots are, and it would be costly, but I think that we might need to do that if we want to have dolphins there for future generations.
Okay, well, on that note, thank you very much, Sue Graham-Taylor.
Okay, thanks a lot.
And thanks for listening to Understory. Remember to visit rtrfm.com.au and subscribe to the Understory podcast so that you never miss a show. I'm Tom Wilson. See you next time.